Hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life. I am intransigently Marcus Freestone. This episode is Consciousness Part 2. Consciousness is directed, i.e. you think about things. My problem is that I often feel my own consciousness is directionless, or that I'm not in control of the things I'm thinking about. I'm also often overwhelmed by the awareness of myself thinking about things, as well as being aware of the things I'm thinking about. This is because consciousness is holistic, i.e. we're aware of many things at once, and concentrating entirely on one thing is virtually impossible. It could be said that consciousness is our awareness at a higher level of low-level neurobiological processes. We cannot possibly process all the millions and billions of daily examples of electrochemical impulses passing between synapses. Therefore, consciousness is our many levels up experience of the functioning of our own brain. We are also, obviously, conscious of the external world, while simultaneously being aware, to some extent, of the activity within our brain whereby that data from the external world is being processed. Does this cause mental confusion? Does it trap us in a never-ending feedback loop? That's sometimes how I feel about my mental experience. It's just occurred to me that the previous sentence has introduced a third level of consciousness. One, we are aware of the external world. Two, we are aware of our brain processing and interpreting the external world. And three, we are aware of how we feel about what our brain is telling us about the external world. In addition to this, we all have our own interior mental life that has nothing to do with our current environment. Worrying about the past or the future, thinking about abstract concepts, making plans, being creative, etc. How does this all fit together into one unified experience called consciousness? I recently read that multitasking is a myth. People who appear to be doing several things at once are, when their brain activity is measured, in fact switching very quickly between tasks. Therefore, consciousness may well be the same. Our awareness is constantly switching between things, perhaps several times a second. Indeed, it has been proved that our conscious brain can only remember 7 bits of information at once. I've always thought that I think far too much. Indeed, more than one person has said this to me. I used to think this was an oxymoron. How could too much thinking be bad? But it depends upon the nature of your thoughts, how positive or negative they are, and how repetitive and intrusive they are. It is said that the average person has 4,000 thoughts a day. I've always thought I had way more than average, but perhaps that is not the case. Maybe I have the same number of thoughts as everyone else, but my consciousness is such that I pay too much attention to them. I've long been aware that I obsess over things, such as going over a totally unimportant snippet of conversation a few dozen times in the following days, or rehearsing an equally unimportant conversation I intend to have for days beforehand, which, now that I think about it, usually leads to me never having the actual conversation. Maybe it seems absurd to say it aloud in front of someone after it's been around my head 30 or 40 times. I've never thought about it until now. If we can be aware of our own consciousness, and aware that we are aware of our own consciousness, are we trapped in a never-ending train of mental abstraction? Is it turtles all the way down? You can see why I have insomnia. I recently read that OCD and other conditions are accompanied by increased activity in certain brain regions. Like consciousness itself, this brings up the chicken and egg question. Does OCD cause increased neuronal activity, or does the activity cause the OCD? I've found for many years that working long hours on a computer, especially for some reason making music, leaves me in a state of mental hyper-alertness where I find it impossible to sleep. Several times after a marathon session of creative activity, I've been wide awake for 48 hours. I become physically and mentally restless, have to go for a 3-hour walk. No matter what I do, I just can't rest and eventually experience disorientation, even hallucinations, as my brain desperately induces REM brain waves while I'm awake. In this state, I feel that I have almost no control over my consciousness. So is it the case that mental hyperactivity can produce anxiety, depression, confusion, bad decision making, etc.? Or do those things that I've mentioned cause the hyperactivity? We are not conscious of everything, of course. For example, ultraviolet and infrared light are beyond our conscious perception. Also, when we look at a table, we see a solid object, not a bunch of loosely spaced, mainly empty atoms vibrating at a level beyond our perception. Therefore, our consciousness is only one possible version of reality, and who's to say which is the right one? But let's not get sidetracked onto too much abstract thinking. I had an interesting experience this week where I attended a course on mindfulness, and I was reminded that in the past I have exerted far greater control over my consciousness than I do now. And I've been wondering why that is. And I could only come to the conclusion that it's down to factors that I've detailed in the book, which are those covered by Gurdjieff and Ouspensky and Colin Wilson. I mentioned Gurdjieff and Ouspensky briefly in the free book, but now I'm going to go into some more detail. I won't go into all the historical detail about who Gurdjieff and Ouspensky were. You can Google that. I will begin by reading a few passages from P.D. Ouspensky's book, The Fourth Way. Gurdjieff came up with this idea that he referred to as the system or the work. And Ouspensky was a journalist who became a pupil of Gurdjieff's and then worked with him. And it was Ouspensky that did the bulk of the writing about Gurdjieff's ideas. And Gurdjieff's books were deliberately obscure because he felt that you had to put the work in to properly understand the ideas. Ouspensky, being a journalist, had more of the common touch and could write and convey the ideas better. So here are a few passages from Ouspensky's The Fourth Way, where he gets to the nub of their ideas about consciousness. If we begin to study ourselves, we first of all come up against one word which we use more than any other, and that is the word I. We say, I am doing, I am sitting, I feel, I like, I dislike, and so on. This is our chief illusion, for the principal mistake we make about ourselves is that we consider ourselves one. We always speak about ourselves as I, and we suppose that we refer to the same thing all the time, when in reality we are divided into hundreds and hundreds of different I's. At one moment when I say I, one part of me is speaking, and at another moment when I say I, it is quite another I speaking. We do not know that we have not one I, but many different I's connected with our feelings and desires, and have no controlling I. These I's change all the time. One suppresses another, one replaces another, and all this struggle makes up our inner life. I's which we see in ourselves are divided into several groups. Some of these groups are legitimate, they belong to right divisions of man, and some of them are quite artificial and are created by insufficient knowledge and by certain imaginary ideas that man has about himself. When Ouspensky says that we have no controlling I, this is in complete agreement with the latest in psychology and neuroscience. As I say in the book, there is no CPU, no central processing unit in the human brain, as there isn't a computer. There isn't one thing in the brain, a center that is us, and that farms out decisions to all the other subordinate parts of the brain. There is no controlling center. There's no controlling I in human consciousness. We know from neuroscience that the brain works in a modular fashion and that there is no part of it that is in control of all the others. So that, for example, the parts of the brain that deal with writing language and understanding spoken language are in different parts of the brain and work completely unconnectedly. So one can cease to function while the other carries on. And we can see this seeming anomaly in people who have had strokes or severe brain injuries. So what Uspensky is saying about the divided nature of the human brain is in complete agreement with modern scientific knowledge. The brain is modular. It is not centrally controlled. Uspensky continues, ordinary psychology is very far from reality. The man it studies is an imaginary quantity. Man is not what he is supposed to be. We ascribe to ourselves many qualities we do not possess. We are not conscious. If we are not conscious, we cannot have unity, cannot have individuality, cannot have an ego or I. All these things are invented by man to keep the illusion of consciousness. Man can be conscious, but at present he is not. It must be recognized that man lives below his legitimate level. There are also other things man may attain, but now I speak of what belongs to him by right, but what he does not have. Our thought has acquired many bad habits, and one of them is thinking without purpose. Our thinking has become automatic. We are quite satisfied if we think of and develop possible side issues without having any idea why we are doing it. From the point of view of this system, such thinking is useless. All study, all thinking and investigation must have one aim, one purpose in view, and this aim must be attaining consciousness. It is useless to study oneself without this purpose. There are reasons to study oneself only if one has already realized that one does not have consciousness and one wishes to attain it. Otherwise, it becomes just futile. Attaining consciousness is connected with the gradual liberation from mechanicalness, for man as he is fully and completely under mechanical laws. The more a man attains consciousness, the more he leaves mechanicalness, which means he becomes more free from accidental mechanical laws. The first step in acquiring consciousness is the realization that we are not conscious. But this illusion cannot be changed alone, for there are many others. As I said earlier, the worst of them is the illusion that we can do. All our life is based on this illusion. We always think that we are doing, when in reality we are not doing anything. Everything happens. Another illusion is that we are awake. When we realize that we are asleep, we will see that all history is made by people who are asleep. Sleeping people fight, make laws. Sleeping people obey or disobey them. The worst of our illusions are the wrong ideas among which we live and which govern our lives. If we could change our attitude towards these wrong ideas and understand what they are, this in itself would be a great change and would immediately change other things. The chief obstacle to the attainment of self-consciousness is that we think we have it. One will never get self-consciousness so long as one believes that one has it. There are many other things we think we have, and because of this we cannot have them. There is individuality or oneness. We think we are one, indivisible. We think we have will, or that if we do not have it always, we can have it, and other things. There are many aspects to this, for if we do not have one thing, we cannot have another. We think that we have these things, and this happens because we do not know the meaning of the words we use. There is a definite obstacle, a definite reason why we cannot have consciousness as we are. This chief obstacle in the way of development is lying. The psychology of lying is really the most important part of the study of the human being. If a man could be described as a zoological type, he would be described as a lying animal. I shall leave out all external lying and take only a man's lying to himself about himself. This is the reason why we are in the state in which we are now, and why we cannot come to a better, a higher, a more powerful, more effective state of consciousness. According to the system we are now studying, we cannot know truth, because truth can be reached only in objective consciousness. So we cannot define what truth is, but if we take it that lying is the opposite of truth, we can define lying. The most serious lying is when we know perfectly well that we do not and cannot know the truth about things, and yet never act accordingly. We always think and act as though we knew the truth. This is lying. When I know that I do not know something, and at the same time say that I know, or act as though I knew it, it is lying. For instance, we know nothing about ourselves, and we really know that we know nothing, yet we never recognize or admit that fact. We never confess it even to ourselves. We act and think and speak as though we know who we are. This is the origin, the beginning of lying. When we understand this and follow this line, and when we try to connect this idea with everything we think, everything we say, everything we do, we will begin to remove the obstacles which lie on the way to consciousness. But the psychology of lying is much more difficult than we think, because there are many different kinds of lying and many very subtle forms hard to discover in ourselves. In others, we see them comparatively easily, but not in ourselves. The first lie we tell ourselves is when we say I. It is a lie because in saying I, we presume certain things. We presume a certain unity and a certain power. And if I say I today and say I tomorrow, it is supposed to be the same I, when in reality there is no connection between them. We are in this present state because of certain obstacles or certain facts in ourselves, and the most important fact that we do not understand is that we have no right to say I, for it will be a lie. When you begin to observe yourself, you will see that it is really so. There are I's in you which do not know one another and never come into contact. For instance, begin to study your likes and dislikes, and you will see that you can like one thing one moment and like another thing another moment, and the two are so opposed to one another that you will realize at once that those I's never meet. If you observe your decisions, you will see that one I decides and another has to carry out the decision, and this one is either unwilling to do it or never heard about it. If you find one thing one does not lie to oneself about, you will be very exceptional. Being surrounded by these lies, born and educated in these lies, we cannot be any different from what we are. We are just the result, the product of this lying. When Ouspensky describes lying, he is describing the same phenomena that Sartre called bad faith, and which I delineate in the book. Bad faith, or lying, is something that if we care to admit it, we know that we are all guilty of. We make excuses to ourselves all the time in our own heads, and then we ignore the fact that we've made an excuse. For example, we will become aware of a fault in ourselves, and we will know that it is within our ability to correct that fault. But we will ignore it. We will, for reasons of laziness or vanity or whatever, we will not correct that fault. And furthermore, we will pretend to ourselves in bad faith that that fault does not exist. We will ignore it, even in the face of us making bad decisions as a result of that fault. We will still pretend that it is not our fault, and that external circumstances are responsible for our failure in this matter. And this leads us into the state psychologists call cognitive dissonance, which I outline in the book. When Ouspensky says that we are not conscious, that is clearly not true. But what that means in the system of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, what they're actually saying is that our current level of waking consciousness is so far removed from what our brains could potentially be that it is little better than sleep. Gurdjieff's premise was that most people are asleep throughout their whole lives and don't even realize it. Hence the title of Colin Wilson's book, The War Against Sleep. And indeed, the whole of Colin Wilson's life and work was devoted to trying to find ways of waking up. Okay, folks, that's it for this episode. Sorry that it's taken me so long to get this one out and that it's a bit shorter than usual, but I've had various tedious health problems the last few months that basically just make me exhausted all the time. So I haven't quite finished off this episode as I'd like, but I thought as it's been so long since the last one, I'd like to just get this one out there now and hopefully a full episode 9 concluding consciousness and all this about Gurdjieff and Ouspensky will be out before very long. Just to conclude by saying that there is now a paperback, Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life, which is available on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and iBooks or whatever the iTunes book thing is called. It's out there. And I've tried to make it as cheap as possible to produce. I've crammed a lot into 100 pages, and it's £6.50 or about $10, $10 US on Amazon. So if you could buy that, that would be very nice. The free book is now heading for about 35,000 downloads. If you haven't already, go and get that from my Smashwords page or whatever. Go to marcusfreestone.com and you'll find links to everything from there. And there's a link to the paperback on my homepage.